You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Hello, it's time for the weekly Corner House podcast, a highlight of everyone's week. I'm your only and regular host, Sarah Perks, Program and Engagement Director, and I'm joined by my distinguished regular contributor, who is a doctor. Yes, I think I've called him Mr. by mistake before. It is actually Dr. Andy Willis from the University of Salford. This week, we got a super major new film on release that I think we're actually both going to agree on. It's 13 Assassins by Japanese prolific auteur Miike Takashi. We've got another illuminating guest interview about our new cartographers exhibition, topped off by a What's On and a staff recommendation from another podcast regular film program manager, Rachel Hayward. This week's film focus, we're really in Andy's area of expertise here with a film called 13 Assassins. So let's give him a chance to show off with some background. Andy, tell us first of all about samurai films.
Well, samurai films are really, really popular in Japan. They're probably the nearest thing you would get to the Western in relation to Hollywood is the samurai film in Japan. They're usually set within a period setting. There's usually lots of politics involved, very codified behaviour, lots of kind of references to Bushido, the code of honour that the samurai warriors followed, lots of political intrigue, anything goes wrong, a bit of suicide, and very, very controlled behaviour. So very, very Japanese. The word that's usually used to describe them is chambara, which means sword fighting film. So in Japan, they're often referred to as chambara films. Interestingly, I think it's interesting, not sure everybody else will, but they were banned during the US occupation of Japan after the war because they were seen to encourage military thinking or martial ways of looking at the world, which obviously after the Second World War they were trying to get the Japanese to be less like. But after that ban was lifted, they became again increasingly popular. Probably for us in the West, the best known samurai film is Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai, 1954. And Kurosawa, again, probably is the name most associated with that genre for us in the West. He made Rashomon, Throne of Blood. Then later in his career, he made Kagemusha and Ran, a big epic adaptation in the samurai vein of King Lear, one of his final films. So it's a genre with a long and complicated history. I think, though, for us, that Akira Kurosawa link gives us a slight false idea. He's obviously a very serious filmmaker who makes kind of acclaimed art movies, but the samurai film in Japan is also a really popular film that's got loads of action and loads of crazy characters and really exciting, fast storylines. Now, if you just pick out some of the famous samurai characters, I think it gives you an indication of that. Probably the most famous samurai character is Zatoichi. People may remember the Takashi Kitano Zatoichi film, which was released a few years ago, which was very popular on the art house circuit. And they made lots and lots of films with that blind swordsman as a central character. There was another series of films with a character called Lone Wolf. He was famous for travelling around with his baby son in a pram and seeing off lots of baddies with his samurai sword. And then my favourite one, which I came across when I was looking around at samurai films today. I've never actually seen one of these films, but by Lord am I looking out now to try and find one. It's a character called Crimson Bat. And Crimson Bat apparently was the female equivalent of Zatoichi, another blind swords woman this time. And apparently there's three films with her as the central character. So I'm certainly going to be hunting out those, I think, on the far reaches of Amazon in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and I'm going to borrow those from you. Okay, but this one is directed by Miike Takashi, who isn't just known for samurai films. Tell us a bit about him, Andy.
Well, he's really a kind of legendary Japanese director. He's something of a maverick. He's very unpredictable. I think with a Takashi Miike film, you're never sure what you're going to get. Some people do have an idea because he's famously the director of Audition, one of the sort of breakout J-horror Asia extreme films in the late 1990s. But his career, well, let's put it this way. He's been making films since 1991, and films and TV series, IMDb says he's made 83. So 83 films in that length of time is pretty good going. So to try and pin anyone down to one genre or one style when they've done that much work, I think would be a foolish thing to do. So he's made kids' films, he's made manga adaptations, he's made triad films, he's made gangster films, he's made serious crime films. He's made crazy musicals. He's done the lot. So you can never be sure what you've got to get. One of the things I found most interesting about 13 Assassins was how, in light of all that, how conservative a film it was. Very classically made, very cleanly shot, very beautiful cinematography. All of the things, in some ways, that such an eclectic and maverick filmmaker as Takashi Miike, you don't actually associate with him.
Okay, and I was saying it the wrong way around. I was like anglicising it, Miike Takashi, but actually it should be Takashi Miike. That's the way around you say it in Japan. But what's this film about then? There must be a story, not just loads of fighting.
Like with all samurai films, this is one of the things I think sometimes people get a bit confused around. They think that these films are just, you know, well, here's the guy with the sword and he's fighting loads of people from beginning to end. But a lot of the classic samurai films, they're usually set in this historical period of the shogunates. I think 13 Assassins is set in 1844. That's a period of quite peaceful time within the shogunate. There's not lots of battles. And the politics of the era is something that comes forward in the film. And that's something that's in a lot of these samurai films. You'll have a kind of lead-in with the politics, the kind of manoeuvring of all the people within the shogunate, all the lords underneath the shogun at the top. And they're all vying for position and wanting to be in control. And this film, 13 Assassins, does that. There's a lot of politicking, people talking in dark rooms, secret plots being plotted, hatched, that's the one, secret plots being hatched. And it revolves around an up-and-coming lord who is deemed to be a very dangerous person if he gets too much power, because basically he's a psycho and he's done lots and lots of terrible things. And so it's whether or not the people in charge are going to do something to prevent his ascension to power. And as the title of the film gives away, so I'm not really telling you anything you don't really know, in a roundabout Seven Samurai, the Magnificent Seven type way, they end up with 13 guys who go to try and assassinate this lord. But it works very well as a samurai film, I think. It's got all of the politics and then, by George, as it got some fighting at the end. Probably just over about, say, an hour and 10 minutes of non-stop samurai sword fighting action.
And I have to say at this point that I absolutely loved it. It's fantastic. I loved the, like, political part at the beginning. I thought at first it was going to get too complicated and I'd have to draw a map or something of who's who. But actually, you know, just go with it. It's fine. It's not confusing at all. And just the best battle scenes I think I've seen for a long time. Andy, what did you think?
What struck me about a lot of the battle scenes is they're done in quite a realist way. So some of the violence is quite shocking. And it kind of brings home how terrible that sort of situation must have been. There are a few things that relate to that. It's probably best not to say. People will sort of draw that out when they watch it. But one thing that struck me was, in this week of the killing of Osama bin Laden, is at the centre of this film is really the morality of sending a group of men to assassinate somebody in the hope that this will prevent lots of terrible things happening afterwards. So it's suddenly, out of the blue, a film that seems to have incredible resonance. And that's one of the things I think samurai films as a genre, certainly in Japan, have been able to do. They've been able to link into the zeitgeist of different periods, whatever's going on. And it looks, out of the blue, like this film has actually done that as well here.
Yeah, that's definitely not on the television ad at the moment. And we'll be looking forward to your comparison in Sight and Sound coming soon. I really do love war films, but I don't think they're just for men. I'd like to make a little plea that even though this is half an epic battle, I think it will appeal just as much to women. It's often the excitement of a battle scene, but it's not just glamorising it. There are messages in there. But actually, sometimes just a really big fight is just amazing to watch and thrilling when it's done properly. So I do think, certainly don't, if you're like, oh, I can't bear samurais, and that's for guys or certain people or Japanese film nerds or whatever you want, it's not. It's for everyone, I think, pretty much, as long as you're over 15.
Yeah, and I think this film really benefits the big screen because some of the choreography of some of the action in the final battle sequences is incredibly detailed. So again, I would really encourage people to get to see it on the big screen if they can.
Yeah, and also our young film critic who posts things on our website gave it 5 out of 5 as well. So it's for young people too. So one for everyone. Can't recommend it enough for once. So that's 13 Assassins, a showing from Friday the 6th of May, definitely for at least 2 weeks. Okay, it's time for our quickfire round. Rather predictably, I'm sure, is best samurai film, Andy.
Well, I mentioned Zatoichi, the Takashi Kitano film. I think I'll go for that rather than one of the more obvious classics from the vault, if you like.
As you mentioned each film, I started to think, oh yeah, Rashomon. Oh no, Zatoichi. But actually, I'm going for Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai. best Takashi Miike film.
Well, I would go for the film that really made me think, bloody hell, I don't usually swear, this fella is doing something odd, was Ichi the Killer, which has got some of the most incredible violence I've ever seen on screen. But it doesn't just work in a violent way. It actually hangs together as a really engaging kind of Yakuza film as well.
And I'm going for Audition. And this is a film I always quote when you see people like passing out in Saw or something that's actually quite a lame horror film. I say, you want to see Audition. And finally, spot the topical link, best film about terrorism.
Well, I would go for the Pontecorvo film Operation Ogre, which was about the assassination plot, well, successful assassination plot to kill Colonel Blanco, the Spanish admiral in Franco's government by ETA in the early 1970s. And the film is a kind of very precise recreation of that operation with a great performance by Gian Maria Voltone, the great Italian actor in it as well.
I'm thinking Paul Greengrass's The 1993 or perhaps the Bader-Meinhof Complex.
It's interesting. It seems that terrorism is a subject that's attracting filmmakers, I think because of the real lives of the people, but also the excitement. You know, certainly something like Bader-Meinhof Complex, very kind of glamorous and exciting characters. It's very, very ambiguous, I think. So, yeah, very interesting area.
And, of course, if you're listening, Chris, sorry, it's actually Four Lions, of course.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
It's time for our mini guide to what's on at Corner House at the moment. This week we have our third film release, so we've got lots of choice this weekend. The third film is called My Dog Tulip, and of course most of you know about how passionate I am about dogs. So this has got dogs. It's a rescue dog as well, which is even better. It's an adult animation. It is actually amazing, quite a short, really well-made film. Can't recommend that one enough as well, so you've got to come, gosh, three times this weekend. So that's My Dog Tulip from Friday the 6th of May. We also have the Arab Maghrebi film season, which is tied into our exhibition New Cartographers. That starts on Tuesday the 10th of May. The first film is one from the archive. It's called Wedding in Galilee. And this is the first film made in Palestine by a Palestinian director. So have a look for more information on our website about that film and the full series. Go to film and then seasons on our website. And now, finally, a treat for you all. We've got a special free screening of new German film, Die Fremde. It was Germany's entry to the Oscars for the Best Foreign Language Picture for 2011. It didn't get shortlisted, but obviously that is an indicator of quality. It tells the story of Ume, a young woman who flees with her son from an abusive marriage from Turkey to her family home in Berlin. And it's also got a free introduction by Maggie Hofgen. So that's Sunday, the 8th of May. Check the times and details on our website.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Back to our current exhibition, New Cartographies. There's a piece called Disappeared in Gallery 2, which is by the Algerian artist Omar D, and it was made for a book by Autograph APB. The co-curator of this exhibition, Ed Welch, has interviewed Tom O'Mara from Autograph ABP about this piece. So over to Ed.
I'm with Tom O'Mara, who's co-director of Autograph ABP in London and has worked closely with Omar D over the last few years, and in particular on the work that's shown in Gallery 2, Disappeared, Devoir de Mémoire. Tom, how did Autograph become involved in working with Omar D?
We'd been interested in working with Omar since we'd seen his work at Bamako, the Rencontre de Bamako, the year I can't tell you, quite a long while now. That was the Portraits project, which were basically magnificent portraits, very dignified portraits of his patients, because Omar is an ophthalmologist. And we were interested in commissioning him to do a piece, and having met Omar and realising that he and I had friends in common and concerns in common, particularly around the issue of the disappeared in Algeria. It seemed logical to actually commission him to work in that area. And it was a project that we then worked out the parameters between the two of us.
So what were the parameters of the project?
Was basically, Autograph, perhaps I should just explain, we are a photographic agency and we have our own premises, but everything we do is concerned with cultural identity and human rights. And we already worked on projects on disappeared in various conflicts, countries like with Marcelo Brodsky in Argentina, and Alfredo Jarre or Alfredo Jarre in Chile. So I personally had a great interest in this. I had quite a knowledge and experience in Algeria myself. So the more I talked with Omar, it seemed logical to pursue this route. And the parameters as such were to find somebody who could introduce Omar to the families of the disappeared, who are fighting to preserve their memory and for truth and justice, as they would say, very much their overriding concern that what had happened in Algeria shouldn't just be buried and forgotten. So SOS Disparu in Algiers and the Association of the Families of the Disappeared in Paris drew up a list of families who would actually be prepared to be photographed and have interviews recorded and even perhaps some video footage to tell their story to be published in a book.
So you produced the book in, it was published in 2007. Can you tell us a little bit about the format of the book and what's in it?
The format of the book followed the process of the commission, really. Omar made a number of journeys to see different members of the different families. We looked at all the material that was gathered to try to get a balance of stories, a balance of experiences. So with the book, we decided to settle on a series of case studies, really, as the format of the book. And the difficulty with the book was to try to make the story of what was happening readable, if you like, understandable, particularly to an English audience, a British audience, that wouldn't be familiar with what had been happening in Algeria, Algeria not being part of our post-colonial history. Not that it is even a colony of France, I suppose. It was France. So we tried to build up a rhythm in the book, not a depressing rhythm, but one which actually detailed the circumstances of disappearance, that documented to a certain extent who was responsible when we knew who was responsible for the violence, and usually the person who was responsible was very well known in the area, that documented the letters that people wrote, desperately trying to find out what happened, and then showing the place of the disappearance, the family who were related to those who disappeared. And often when I say not to be too depressing about it, but also to show the children, the next generation, who would often be taking up this struggle against the state violence that had happened.
One of the striking things in the book and the thing that we've brought out for the show is the use of identity photos within it. That plays a very important role in exploring this question of loss and memory in the book, doesn't it?
It does. The identity photo is the most precious possession of the family. And paradoxically, it's the identity photo that they are prepared to hand over to the associations that are fighting for the truth of what happened to the people who disappeared, so that they could be attached to a dossier, so that the photos can be sent to the state authorities, who obviously are the people who are responsible in the large part for these disappearances in the first place. So there is this paradox that the identity photo is very, very precious, and at the same time, people are prepared to hand them over if they're going to be a useful tool. And for that reason, obviously, reproducing identity photos in the book could be considered quite an obvious device, but it does enable people to guess at the amplitude of what the problem is.
What was Omar Dee's relationship to the project as it took place over time?
Very emotional. I mean, Omar got hugely involved. You could not possibly work on this project without it probably taking quite an emotional toll on you. It certainly did to everybody who was involved in the project. It's difficult to say. Omar invested hugely in the project. It's not something you want to undertake lightly. Omar Dee, you could say, is the only photographer, I think, really, actually permanently based in Algeria during the 90s, during all the period of the Salguer, or the Dirty War. So you do have to, I mean, as the French would say, assume a certain responsibility, really, for what you're doing there, and he's very conscious of that.
What impact has the book had since its publication?
The book was always intended to be used as a means of counteracting many of the lies which had gone round, and really of the propaganda that the Algerian state had put out concerning the disappeared. The disappeared is a story that they want to bury, so much so that after the charter, so-called, for reconciliation had been brought in, people were then, it became a criminal offence even to speak about disappearances, huge fines, mandatory either 3 or 5 year sentences. The impact of it has been that it's been something that could be presented to politicians, presented to NGOs, presented to campaigning organisations. It was cited by the United Nations as part of their Commission on Torture in Algeria as evidence. So it has been strategically used and strategically disseminated where it was felt it could be of most use.
His more recent work that's also on display in the show marks something of a break from the work on the disappeared, exploring other facets of contemporary Algeria. This is perhaps in part a reaction to his emotional investment in the disappeared project, would you say?
I don't know that I entirely agree, because it's very much a strand of work that Omar had been carrying on before. Omar has had a huge pride in his own country. The work on the portraits was very much a celebration, in a sense, of life on the margins, but also of traditional Berber life, the colour, the dignity and heritage and cultural resilience of the country. So I would really see the work that's being exhibited here as being a continuation of that. He's worked in on different kinds of subject in parallel over a number of years.
So New Cartographers Algeria France UK is in all three of our galleries until Sunday the 5th of June, and it is of course free.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
It's time for our staff recommendation of the week. So we're going to hear from Rachel Hayward, our film programme manager, who's talking about Outside the Law.
Our audiences are really going to like Outside the Law. It's a very emotional film, but it's very, very fast-paced. It's very slick and glossy. And Rashid Bouchareb, the director, has really done a very good job of creating a quality narrative. In many ways, it's a very standard film, very standard storytelling, but it's so well done and so polished. And the performances are great from the three leads who play the three brothers, that it comes together very, very well. I was really lucky to be able to watch Outside the Law last year in Cannes, and it was really interesting to see the film in France with a high proportion of French critics in the audience. And one of the major things of the particular screening in Cannes was that the security was incredibly high around the main palais where the screening was held. It was the one day we got all our bags checked, all our water bottles taken away from us. I can understand why there's these kind of feelings and these necessities, but it was really interesting nonetheless. And it just goes to show quite how sensitive a topic the Algerian relationship is in France at the moment. The film tells the story of a family, so mainly focusing on a mother and three brothers who are all grown up, who lose their home in Algeria, and then each of the brothers goes off on a different path in France, and one of them turns to petty crime, goes to the criminal underworld in Pigalle in Paris and gets involved in dancers and all sorts of shady dealings. One of the brothers goes down a very radical political route, and one of the brothers goes down a military route. As an audience, we see how each of these three individuals, despite their shared roots and their shared anger at their own situation, we see the different journeys that the three brothers take and how it brings them back to the relationship with their mother. Outside the Law also ties in really nicely with our Arab and Maghrebi film season, and that in itself has been scheduled to complement our current exhibition. So if anyone hasn't already been up to have a look at New Cartographers, it's well worth seeing both the exhibition and the film season and Outside the Law all as a complementary mix.
So thank you, Rachel. That was Outside the Law, which is screening from Friday the 6th of May. Do check our website for times. And also there's an introduced screening on Sunday the 8th of May at 5 p.m. by Dr. Joe McGonigal, one of the co-curators of New Cartographers. That just about concludes our podcast for this week. Next week, Andy's on holiday, so if you know where he lives, the key's under the mat. And I'll be talking instead to Dr. Joe McGonigal, and we'll be talking about Francophone cinema, in particular, A Screaming Man. So you can search for everything that we've talked about today on our website, www.cornerhouse.org. Arigato, Dr. Andy Willis, and I'll see you all next week.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast.